You're listening to Thoughtcast. I'm Jenny Attia. Up next, the European Union. Here in America, we hardly give it a thought. Why so? Is it because we're just uninformed? Or maybe, as Timothy Garton Ash writes in his syndicated column, it's also a reflection of a reality in which, for most of the world, the EU really doesn't count for much, and certainly not for as much as it thinks it does. That's quite a quote, but is it true? Are we justified in ignoring the EU, or might we come to regret it? Alberto Alesina is one to know. He's the Nathaniel Ropes Professor of Political Economy at Harvard, and he's recently written a book called The Future of Europe, Reform or Decline. Alberto Alesina, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Thank you for having me.
Just this past June, the European Union held a summit to determine its future, really, and it was hoped to rescue it from embarrassment and failure. Do you think it was successful?
I think it was certainly a step in the right direction because it was a step and not a jump or an attempt to do something which was unrealistic and fundamentally flawed like the European Constitution. It was a step in the right direction because it made some simple and sensible changes. One was that to turn the rotating presidency of the EU from 6 months to 2.5 years, which gives a president more time to actually do something, to have some qualified majority voting rather than unanimity in a few important issues. Of course, now it remains to be decided how to allocate the voting rights amongst the member country, and in particular Poland and the Czech Republic seem unhappy about the allocation of voting rights, which is roughly proportional to the population, but with smaller country getting more power in terms of voting rights given their population. But I think looking in the big picture is that when countries have to decide how to share some pie or some power, they will always be trying to get more. So I hope that in the end everybody will be reasonable.
In your new book, The Future of Europe, you argue that unless some serious reforms are taken in continental Europe, in its economy, it will eventually stagnate and become irrelevant. But actually, the economy's been doing quite well in Europe in recent years, hasn't it?
Well, it depends on what you mean by well. It depends on what you mean by recent years. Europe has been... A good comparison for Europe is to compare towards the United States. And I think Europe has been catching up in terms of growth and GDP per capita relative to the U.S. up until about the late 70s, early 80s. When it reached about two-thirds of the GDP per capita of the U.S., then relative to the U.S., it stagnated for a couple of decades, and now from the mid-90s, actually losing ground. So Europe is actually, even in terms of measured GDP per capita, losing ground compared to the U.S., and the last decade has been rather poor in terms of economic performance of Europe as a whole. Certain countries are doing worse than others, but on average, the European Union is losing ground relative to the U.S. So the argument of the book is that without some serious reform in continental Europe, the quote that you started with about Europe becoming irrelevant and thinking of itself as more important than it actually is will become actually a reality.
What about the euro? It's done rather well against the dollar for quite some time. Doesn't that indicate genuine strength?
No, I think it's not clear. Certain currency can be high or low, and that doesn't mean that the economy underlying the currency are doing well or badly. It's not the fact that euro is strong doesn't mean that the European Union is doing better now than it was doing 5 years ago when the euro was lower. In fact,
why not?
Let me give you an example. The euro could be high. I'm not saying that it is, but it certainly could be high because interest rates in Europe are very high, and in the U.S. are low. Now, high interest rate in Europe may actually hinder growth in Europe, and therefore the euro being high may be actually a problem for the growth of Europe. So there have been periods in history where the dollar was very low and the U.S. economy was growing like crazy and vice versa. So high or low of a currency is not an indication of health of an economy.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm speaking with the Harvard economist and author, Alberto Alesina. Alberto, it's pretty clear from what I've read of your work that you all things considered, prefer the U.S. economic model to the European one, but you do not advocate at the same time that Europe adapt in full the U.S. model. Why not?
Well, to begin with, I'm not sure that I necessarily prefer the U.S. model as a whole. I certainly, there are a lot of things of the U.S. model that I admire and I think are very growth enhancing. There are some aspects of it which are deficient. Anyway, more specifically to your question, why Europe should not or would not adopt is because, well, the relevant point is that Europe will not adopt the U.S. model for the very simple reason that Europeans are much more averse to inequality than Americans, and they're much more favorable to social welfare, social security, and social safety net. So from the point of view of the book and the point of view of policy advocates, fairly useless, in fact counterproductive, to tell the European you should do like American, because that really gives you, you irritate people and you get the opposite reaction. So the way to push some message of policy reform is to say you don't have to do like the US, but there are some things that you can do, keeping your identity, improve market activities, for example. But telling Europeans, do like the US, is a completely the wrong starting point.
Not very diplomatic.
Not very diplomatic, and you get targeted as an American lover or a Bush lover or something that...
You support the war in Iraq all of a sudden.
Exactly. You support the war in Iraq, and you become associated with everything that Europeans see as bad in the US. So, in fact, we are writing a second book in Italian, targeted for an Italian audience, because the first book you referred to, it was very popular in Italy, it was a bestseller. And we got from somebody the accusation of being just simply pro-American and just wanted to adopt the American model for Italy. And I think we are writing a rebuttal to explain that view. But so that's an example of the fact that if you are casted as somebody who just wants to copy America, that's the wrong way to start to influence policy in Europe.
You have lived in the U.S. for a long time. You've studied here and you've taught here at Harvard. What do you think about the U.S. economic model and its healthfulness?
I think the American economic model is based on a fundamentally correct principle, namely that, especially after the late 70s and the deregulation that came with the 80s, is based on a good principle, namely that market work and the government should let market do their job, and the economy should not be overregulated, and often excessive policy intervention end up creating worse problems than it's trying to solve. It's based on a good principle of reasonably low taxes compared to European countries. So the fundamental principles are all there. Of course, nothing is perfect. The U.S. have a bunch of problems. One is that the growing inequality may become, not only is a problem per se, might become a situation that will create, if not social unrest, certainly social demand for redistribution. And if those are not dealt with promptly, they may degenerate.
Into what? Because this is something we never discuss here, do we? The issue of what might happen if people who are not doing so well here get fed up.
For one thing, I mean, the Americans, even the poor American, have a much higher tolerance than the European for inequality. I mean, Americans tend to view inequality as a ladder that you can climb, while Europeans tend to see inequality as a completely social evil that should be fought very aggressively. So the Americans of all level of income have a much higher tolerance for inequality. So, of course, if things become extreme, you know, you can think of riots or perhaps connected with racial animosity. These are problems which are difficult to solve, and many European countries are not doing much better than the U.S. in terms of eliminating those problems or creating different ones. So these are difficult issues that sometimes increasing inequality is really something that comes from the transformation of the U.S. economy into a service economy, and globalization and all of that. So you need to, on the one hand, avoid extreme increase in inequality, on the other hand, not prevent market to do their jobs.
Those who defend the American way say that the increasing inequality hides the fact that the poorer are doing significantly better than they would have before, that the money coming in does lift all boats, even though the inequality still exists and has worsened.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I think that that there is a very big difference between inequality and poverty, and that's a confusion that is often made, sometimes strategically, especially in Europe. Inequality can increase and still poverty can go down. And also what the definition of poverty changes. I mean, a poor person in the U.S. today is doing much, much better than even a reasonably wealthy person in the U.S. in the 1800s. So the definition of poverty changes quite a bit. So one has to be quite careful. In Europe, there is a tendency to confuse the two. And people in Europe, people hate inequality just because of inequality, even though don't pay attention to the difference in inequality and poverty. In the U.S., unfortunately, in some areas, poverty has gone up too. But again, the poverty is also poverty is a relative concept.
Speaking of globalization, Alberto, there's obviously pressure for everyone to get on the bandwagon and work as hard as the Americans are working and be as productive as they are out of fear that everyone else will fall behind. But is that really necessary? Does everybody have to start imitating the U.S. work-life balance, or should I say imbalance, in order to be economically viable?
Well, it depends who you are talking about. If you're talking about China or India or countries that have to come out of poverty, they certainly have to work hard to come out of poverty. There's no question about it. And in fact, probably the Chinese work much harder than the Americans. So that's no question that if you want to come out of poverty, you have to work hard. I think the question is more subtle if you're comparing U.S. versus Europe. And one argument is that Europeans don't like to work as hard as Americans. And that may be true, but the question is, it's a very complex question because on the one end, they were working even harder than Americans in the 60s until the mid-70s. Then they started working less and less. But for a while, until the late 80s, early 90s, they were very productive when they were working. So they were essentially keeping up with the Americans because they were productive when they were working. Now they work less and they're not as productive. At least the productivity growth is not as high as it used to be. So they're losing ground relative to the U.S. because they're not working as much and the productivity results are not as spectacular, particularly for certain countries in continental Europe.
But is this a bad thing, fundamentally?
Right. Well, the question is, does relative decline matter? You may say Europe certainly is not to become poor from one day to the next. Even if a country has 60%, 50% of the GDP per capita of the U.S., still can be a rich country, and therefore we shouldn't care. That may be true, but then we go back to the original quote, namely, fine, but then Europe should stop considering itself as a great power, and there will be a place where it's nice to live, and you take a lot of vacation, but you won't be as important as you think you are economically and politically, because political influence comes with economic influence. And I already have the feeling, I smell in the air the idea that when you talk about what's going on in the world, the talk is now much more about U.S., China, U.S. and the Middle East, East, and Europe is sort of there, like some of my colleagues call Europe a museum, where you go to the museum to look at beautiful culture.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atia, and I'm speaking with the Harvard economist and author Alberto Alesina. What would you like to see happen to the primarily continental European economy over the next 5 to 10 years? And how does what you would like to see compare to what you think will happen?
I would like to see essentially three things. One is liberalization of the service sector, you know, from banking to transportation to telecommunication, technology. 70%, 80% of the GDP of our so-called industrial economies. And in Europe, it's still fairly regulated. So I would like to see a large deregulation and liberalization of the service sector, labor market reform that make labor market more flexible and they eliminate hiring and especially firing costs and introduce instead unemployment compensation for people that are temporarily unemployed, but eliminate restriction on legal and economic cost of firing. And third, I would like to see a serious thought about the pension system and reforming the pension system in such a way that makes them sustainable in the long run. And in fact, fourth, I'd like to see some more serious thought about what to do with immigration, which is a huge issue for Europe. What's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years? I think a lot will depend on what happens in France, frankly. I think that if Sarkozy manages to do what he claims that he will do, and he manages to pass a labor reform that he has been talking about without major unrest, and he's essentially successful in doing what he suggested to do, I think it will be a very strong signal for Italy, Germany, Spain, and other countries in continental Europe to follow the line and showing that this reform can be done without excessive unrest. If instead Sarkozy fails, that's going to be a very serious step back. So in 6 or 7 months, we will have a much better answer to your question. In the fall, when Sarkozy starts doing his reform, we'll see what happens.
Well, speaking of France, the previous president, Jacques Chirac, tried to make these changes that you're hoping Sarkozy can make, and he failed utterly. He wanted to make it possible for companies to fire people. And when this was news, there was rioting in the streets, and he had to back down immediately. Where is the political will going to come from to make this sort of thing happen, particularly in France?
Well, Chirac was a fairly, in this area, undecisive leader, so was his prime minister, Villepin. I think that people knew that, so people knew that they could make him back down if they yelled loudly enough. Sarkozy seemed more decisive and been elected clearly with that platform. He has sometimes a mandate to do it because he said it before the election that he was going to do. And it seemed to be also the technicalities or the aspects, specific aspect of the labor reform seemed to be better thought out than the previous ones. So all of that goes in his favor. Having said that, I think there's a very high chance that he will face really strong social unrest, and then we'll see how events unfold. But he has some element relative to Chirac to his advantage, but it's certainly not going to be an easy battle.
Alberto, if I understand you correctly, you really advocate a sort of kinder, gentler capitalism, where regulations on businesses are reduced, but where there's still a decent welfare system to take care of the people who do lose their jobs. But could it be said that this is a bit like having your cake and eating it too?
No, I don't think so. I strongly disagree with that because let me give you an example with unemployment compensation. Suppose that you do have reasonably generous unemployment compensation, but firm can fire people. If firm can fire people, they would be less afraid to hire people precisely because they know that they're not stuck with somebody they don't want. So more jobs will become available relative to now. So very few people would stay unemployed for long. So the unemployment compensation would not be that expensive because very few people would be unemployed. So if you reduce firing costs, unemployment goes down, not up. And therefore, if unemployment goes down, in fact, it becomes cheaper to temporary subsidies for the unemployed. So it's not that expensive, actually. But more generally, quite apart from the specific example, more generally, I would put it slightly different from the way you put it. I would say that I am a free marketeer who thinks that market should be let function, and then you can achieve as much or as little redistribution and social safety net, depending on what your preferences are. But you should do it in a way that doesn't overregulate and interfere with the market. So, for example, let the market work, but then have, say, progressive income taxation if you want to tax the rich more than the poor. But don't do it by messing up with the way market function. And that's the way a lot of the problem in Europe rely precisely on that of interfering with the market mechanism. And also, I should also say that a lot of the redistribution that go on in Europe often favor not the really poor, but unionized insider workers, public employee, all sorts of people that are not necessarily the very poor. So I'm also in favor of dismantling a lot of the social welfare structure in Europe, which doesn't go to the very poor. You can achieve the same level of protection of the poor with a much lower spending over GDP in many countries in Europe, starting with Italy.
Well, that just answers my second question, which is, wouldn't the taxes have to remain pretty high to provide a decent social safety net? And you're saying no.
Again, that's a matter of domestic
degree.
That's a matter of degree. I think that if your goal is really to protect the very poor, taxes don't have to be that high if you let the market provide a lot of the public goods that are now produced publicly. So, for example, in the UK, the taxes over GDP are much lower than in countries in continental Europe. But according to some OECD statistic, the UK does just as well as protecting the poor than countries like Italy or Spain or Greece, or then spend much more. Now, Scandinavian countries, they spend more and they do a good job, but that's their choice. But I don't think you can certainly satisfy what you describe as a kinder, gentler capitalist without going to the extreme of the Nordic European countries, who function well for a variety of reasons that I'm not sure that can be exported to other countries.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm speaking with the economics professor, Alberto Alesina. Alberto, when people talk about the welfare economy of the European Union, they're largely talking about continental Europe and Scandinavia. And of course, that excludes the UK, as you mentioned earlier, and Ireland, which are more market-based. What I would really like to know is why so many market-based economies are in countries where they speak English. The US, the UK, Canada, Australia. Is there a connection?
You know, that's a fascinating question, because if in fact think of the UK and Ireland, you know, one is Protestant, the other is Catholic. They fought with each other. It's a fascinating question. I'm not sure I know the answer, actually. You could think of the Protestant ethics, but again, Ireland, although Ireland could be the exception. In Ireland until the late 80s was an example of a disaster, although Ireland is an example of how actually some market-oriented reform can all of a sudden turn around a country and turn it into a tiger from a disaster. So,
and the Asian economies do rather well, it's not.
And they don't speak English. So I'm not sure whether there may be, you know, my colleague Andre Schleifer at Harvard talks about legal origin, and it may have something having to do with the legal system, the Anglo-Saxon legal system versus the French legal system, may have something to do with promote economic growth and development. It's one of those questions that would require, actually would be a nice book to write. I mean, why English-speaking countries?
Alberto, before we wrap up, we really should talk about the military in the European Union, or should I say the lack of military. Do you think that it's necessary for the EU, if it is to move forward and become a strong political entity, a legitimate power, that it have an army?
The question is, I would put it slightly different. Is it possible for Europe to have a cohesive foreign policy and B, an army to support that foreign policy? And I think the answer, at least for the foreseeable future, is no. I don't think that Europe agrees on a foreign policy. And therefore, you're missing the foundation. If you want to have a common army, you must have some sort of either agree on a common policy or at least to agree to delegate to somebody the choice of foreign policy. So we are very far from it. The failure of the Constitution reflects in part that distance. So I don't think it's going to happen. The other thing is that the Europeans hate military spending. I think they have no clue about how expensive it is to have a serious army. So with the exception of the English and perhaps a bit of the French, they have no clue about what it means to have a serious army. So if they got to the point of having a really serious army, they would be shocked by how much it would cost. And then what do you do with countries which already have high taxes and they don't have enough money to pay pensions?
There goes the vacation,
exactly. That's exactly a point of the book. You know, as long as you don't want to have an army, you don't want to be that important in the international arena, you don't want to be a player, then go on vacation. That's fine. That creates a great life. But don't complain if then the U.S. don't call you up when they have to decide what to do.
But what are the longer-term implications of the EU, of Europe, sort of skipping all of that and not having a say in the world? Will there be a power vacuum?
I don't know what's going to happen to the division of power in the world, but I think that is probably counterproductive to pretend that there is something like EU in foreign policy when it really doesn't exist.
So, Alberto Alesina, what's it going to be for Europe? Reform or decline?
If you asked me a year ago, I would have said 80% probability decline and 20% reform. Now I would probably say 50-50. I think the victory of Sarkozy, some movement in Germany are encouraging. We'll see. I hope that Sarkozy makes it. That would have a very strong positive signal for the rest of Europe.
Well, Alberto Alesina, thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Alberto Alesina, the Harvard professor and author of The Future of Europe, Reform or Decline, on ThoughtCast. If you'd like to leave a comment, please go to our website at thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.